Hi, everybody. My name is Beverly Burnett, and I am a very grateful recovering Al-Anon. This is really a pleasure to be invited to come to Arkansas and share with you today. Dave called me several months ago, and I felt, you know, at that time that it was a real privilege for me to be here. And he sort of took me up at the airport yesterday and made me feel really welcome, and you are all so friendly, and I feel, I don't feel like I'm even away from home. But it's nice, you know, it's a wonderful part of this fellowship that no matter where we go, we always see people we know. You know, we're never alone. And George and I have an opportunity to travel a lot and be in the fellowship in different parts of the country. And we always find a familiar face, and if we don't, we make one right away. And I think that's the real blessing that we get. The real recovery part is about the friendship that we have in this fellowship. And I'm just real excited to be here today. The first time I heard Brad do a big book study, and they finished and everybody applauded in two bars, I thought that was just really neat. I'm glad she's here. Kathy and Water have been friends of mine for a long time, and as we see each other at conferences and along the way, we've developed a warm and friendly friendship, and for that I'm real grateful. Thank you. I came into the fellowship of Al-Anon in 1981 in February, and since then, my life has definitely changed. Recovery for me is slow. I learned my lessons in the Al-Anon fellowship slowly, and it's really, for me, recovery is one day at a time. And I'm always amazed at myself when I'll be sitting in a meeting or sitting in meditation, and I'll have one of these odd experiences and know that was information I got the very first day of Al-Anon, and for some reason or other it has gone from my head to my heart, and I know what it means. And I think to myself, it takes a lot of time, a lot of meetings, a lot of people talking to me, a lot of me talking to other people for those things to happen, for me to understand what it means. And one of the newest revelations that I've had, you know, we hear the steps, the traditions, the slogans, and we hear all about recovery usually in our first meeting, but it takes a lifetime for that all to become a part of the process and for us to be able to grow and develop through that. And I was sitting only a week ago when I understood completely about what it meant to stay out of my husband's business. And I really, it finally just, I mean, it's thinking in a level down here about what that really means. And I thought, oh my God, I've been here 8.5 years, and it took that long for me to understand. But I've learned a lot of other things since then, and that was just the one thing that I understood that day. And so what I think, you know, I've heard this little thing about don't stop coming before the miracle. But I think the miracle happens every day here in Al-Anon, and I can't stay away from the meeting because I know I'm going to miss it. I'll give you a little bit. We're supposed to tell a little bit about how it was, what happened, and what it's like today. And today, what I'm going to tell you about when I get to that part is not that things are wonderful. And I think you get here and think that once we get into recovery and once he's sober or the kid is sober or whatever, that life is going to be wonderful. And when we start to have living problems in recovery, sometimes we think we were doing the program wrong. And I'm here to tell you that we have had the most dramatic problems happened to us in recovery. Far worse things have happened to us in recovery than ever happened to us when we were living in active alcoholism. And I am extremely grateful today that I have had the tools of recovery to get through the things that have happened to us in the last 5 years, because I don't know how I could have handled the crises that we've come up against if I was running around there as crazy as I was in 1981. And today I can get through these things and I can try to understand God's way in them and not think to myself, you know, I have a little card I've carried in my wallet since 1982 that says that sometimes the seemingly bad things are necessary for our growth, and I can look at that today and understand the spiritual principle in that, and to be able to apply the tools and to understand that God's not out to get me, because that was my attitude about life before I got here, was God was going to get me and the kids and him and everybody. And he has taught me about the loving, caring God that we have here in this fellowship. So one of the things that, you know, I like to encourage is that life does not yet wonderful, and our problems do not stop on the days that we get into recovery. They keep happening, but today, thank God, we have some tools. And if we stop long enough to think what tool we should get out of the bag and use, we can do a lot better. There's a lady in Dallas that, you know, I came here and I was really, I did not understand anything about what was going on. And there's a lady, and I believe it's, that she's a member of the Preston group, and she walks around and does step studies, and she has this little canvas bag, and it's a tool bag. And you know, you talked about the tools, and I didn't know what they were. I didn't know that it was the Obad book and the slogans and the traditions, and I walked around here for 6 months or a year, and I wasn't exactly sure what you were talking about when you talked about the tools. And finally, one day, Vesta came to our group, and she carried in her little tool bag, and she said, and today we're going to talk about the tools of recovery. And she laid them all out on the table, and it was an Obad book, and the 12 and 12, and some slogans, and a God box. And I thought, my God, I've been using them. I did not know what they were. So the other message I have for you today is don't be afraid to ask questions. and I didn't know if I was working the steps for a long time after I got there. I'd walk around and think, God, did I do step one? And did I do step two? And have I done step three? And I wasn't really sure. And one of the tools that we have in the Dallas area is that we have people that go around the groups and they're willing to share their experience, strength, and hope for 4 weeks, for an hour each week, and they tell how they did the steps. And the first time that I heard somebody do the steps, it was a lady named Jean, and she was an elementary school teacher, and she talked elementary, animated elementary, and she talked in a real simple way about how she worked the steps in her life. And I sat there, and one more time I was relieved because I could see that even though it was primitive, I had started to be able to put the steps to work in my life, and I was real grateful for that. So take advantage of everything that's offered here. You know, get the tools, get a sponsor, do whatever you need to do, because recovery is slow, but it's worth hanging around for. And I am here to be your cheerleader about that, because I know it works, and today I don't know where I would be. The other thing that I think is the most is really important about recovery is laughter. The laughter in the program was another big healing for me. I mean, I took life so serious. It was just so terrible. I had two drug-addicted alcoholic children and this husband. I couldn't get home to work, and there just never seemed to be enough money, and I couldn't go anywhere because who would watch them? And it was just real. I mean, it was a real drama, and I know you laughed. You know, look at him, he laughs. Everything here is funny. and the most fun, you know, I know that meetings are serious. We have to talk about serious things. But I like to go out for lunch afterwards and laugh. You know, sit around at gatherings and laugh because it feels good to me. Then my sides hurt and I just laugh about that nonsense. But I thought, God, if I ever told anybody, what would they think? You know, that was my attitude. So the laughter heals, and take advantage of, you know, sharing your life and looking at yourself from a different point of view and knowing, you know, that for the 6 months, it's a big deal. You know, we are here now, and whatever happened before just isn't such a big deal. Then I start to tell you a little bit about what it was like for me. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and I lived in a Polish and Czechoslovakian neighborhood. Everything that I did or that our family did was revolved around alcohol. You know, whether it was a christening or a wedding or Thanksgiving or Christmas or the Irish holiday in March or whatever, you know, 4th of July, there was always the first thing that anybody, from what I can remember, was concerned about was what we were going to have to drink. You know, we got to need to get the ice and get the pub out in the backyard and everything else. And if it was going to be a holiday, be sure you got enough before the liquor store closes. And it seemed to me until I got into the program that alcohol was always the most important ingredient to any gathering, you know. And the other thing that I know from the time that I was small was that mostly everybody left whatever gathering and they were drunk. And so as time progressed, I didn't know that there was anything wrong with that. I thought that that's the way it was. You know, that was the way, I mean, from the very first day that I opened my eyes and could see what the world was, people were drinking a lot of liquor. And so, when I got married some years later, and my husband drank exactly the same way that my father did, there was nothing wrong with that as far as I was concerned. You know, he was exactly, and you know, I heard a story not too long ago about a dog that just before she delivered some puppies was in an accident and her back legs were taken, and she raised these puppies, and the story went on that as the puppies watched the mother go along, that they also dragged their back end along, you know, and I thought to myself, that's how I was, you know, I saw how this was, and I didn't know that there was any other way, you know, I thought that was life. So it wasn't until I walked into a treatment facility with my 15-and-a-half-year-old son that somebody said to me, you have probably got a large dose of alcoholism at your house. And I went, alcoholism? You know? This is exactly the way it's always been. You know, so I didn't know. And I think today that a lot of the education, you know, and they talk about the elephant in the kitchen and ignoring the elephant, I think it's neat today that people have an opportunity to know that that's probably not normal. Because what I thought was normal just down here killed me. So, anyhow, mostly, the other thing that happened is we had all these family events and different occasions and holidays and things, and liquor was always the main event. But the other thing is it was real controversial because liquor was the main event that my mother would tell my father that he shouldn't drink so much. You know? And so, it was like everybody got real tense around the house because we didn't ever know how much was going to be too much. You know, we didn't know where the turning point was, where one drink was not going to be so much and when one is going to be too much. And so when I knew that it was too much is when my mom got really mad at my dad, and then I thought, okay, this is too much. And the next thing that would happen after that is that there would be fighting and yelling, and the house would get tense, and my mom and dad wouldn't talk for a week. And I would come home from school, and I can remember this. I can feel that tension today. If I want to feel that, I can feel how I feel. And I would come home from school and think, I wonder if they're going to be talking today. You know, because if they weren't talking, then my mom would say, and tell your father this, and my father would say, and tell your mother this. And finally, one day I would come home, and they were telling each other, and I think, it was a relief. And so that went on. And I know today that most all the arguments that they had in the house, and it was a violent house in as much as it was a lot of verbal abuse type stuff. Also, my mother was raised in active alcoholism, and she never told me very much about her family at all, except that I know that they were very, very poor, and the little bit of money that they did have, my grandfather drank up, and she did tell me one time that when he drank, he would beat my grandmother up. So, I mean, that's all we need to know. Probably my grandfather was an alcoholic. So, probably my mother could have used our program. And I know today she could have used the program. What she did was exactly what I said I would never do and did. You know, it's just the way we are. I said to myself when I was a little kid that when I got married and I grew up, I was never going to yell at my kids. I wasn't going to hit them. I wasn't going to do all those things. And I'm here to tell you that by the time I did get married and did have children, I did all those things and probably more. And I'm real sorry about that, but today I have a program and I have a way to make an amend to those children and to try and change my life, and that's my living amend to my sons today and to my husband. But anyhow, there was a lot of screaming and yelling and just weird things that went on, and I don't need to describe them. We've all been there. Anybody, you know, if you're all sitting in this room, you're involved in alcoholism and you know what it was like. When I was in fourth grade, one of the things that I want to tell you is that alcoholism did not create my character defects, it enhanced them. I had all of my character defects before I came into the Al-Anon Fellowship, and I also had them before I married my husband. The other thing I like to say is that being an Al-Anon is not a character defect. It's a fellowship. It's a 12-step program. And the other thing that I usually start out by saying is that I am an Al-Anon not because I'm an American alcoholic and have two alcoholic sons. I go to a lot of meetings. I work with steps. I have a sponsor. And that's what makes me an Al-Anon. And in the little job that George and I do, I have people come to me all the time and they'll say, oh, do you have a tape from our sick little Al-Anon? And I said, well, when's the last time your sick little Al-Anon came to a meeting? And I said, oh, she won't go to meetings. Well, she is not an Al-Anon. concern. I am proud to be an Al-Anon. I worked my tail off to be an Al-Anon. I kind of forgot where I was. When I was telling you about my character defects, that I had them before I had married George and the alcoholism did enhance my character defects. One of the first things I remember was when I was about 5 years old and my need to be a part of, you know, to have friends. And I got scared, traded, and did whatever I could to manipulate a friendship. And I never felt like what I was as of myself was enough. I felt I either had to give you my pencils or my crayons or let you ride my bike or give you all my crap stuff, my soda bottles, or whatever I had to give it to you in order to earn your friendship. And that was one of my character defects. So that I knew by the time I was a little kid. I can remember trading off stuff so that you would let me be a part of. When I was in fourth grade, we moved from Chicago to a suburb of Chicago, and we did that in the middle of the school year, and it was real interesting to me because I can remember how important I felt because the teacher said, we have a new girl in school today, and I want you all to be nice to her, and it didn't cost me anything that time. I just walked in, and everybody wanted to take the new kid out to lunch and have her sit at their table. And then all of a sudden, you know, they started to make choices about who liked me and who didn't. And then I started the trade-off again, you know, to be a part of, to want to feel a part of. And it was really important to me to have the right stuff, you know, to have the right ice skates, to have the right bicycle. Mine never looked like yours. You know, my mom and dad felt like, you know, financially they weren't always able to give me exactly what I wanted. And so sometimes I always felt like my stuff looked funny compared to yours. And it was really important for me to have all the right things. That was another character defect, you know, a part of the same one. When I was in the summer between my junior and senior year of high school, my dad lost his job and we were transferred to Salt Lake City, Utah, actually Ogden, Utah. And for about 4 months prior to the move, in no time, I got to feel real important because there was nobody in the school that ever lived in Utah, didn't know anybody that lived in Utah, and all of a sudden he said, so everybody's moving to Utah and they wanted to know about Utah. Now, I had never seen it. I didn't know what a mountain looked like. I did not know what anything about it was, but I became an authority on Utah based on what I felt it was going to be like, and I got a lot of attention in that. The one thing that happened, and it happens in alcoholic homes, is that, you know, we don't support each other emotionally. You know, there's not a lot of communication. And so one day my dad said he was going to Utah, and my mom said, and we're leaving in June. And nobody really ever stopped to tell me that this could be traumatic, you know. That by the time you've gone through all of those years of school with the same friends, and you're a senior, and you're going to leave, that would be very traumatic. And not only was it traumatic, but there wasn't people in that household who could help me get through that. And consequently, it turned out to be the most difficult year of my life, I think. But it seems like that today. It was a real difficult year. So anyhow, here I am getting all this attention about moving to Utah. And finally the day came, and we got on a train, and we get to Utah, and I realized that most of what I had told these uninformed people was not true. You know, the streets were paved. They did have cars. They had parking meters. There were not Indians and cowboys and everything else. It looked pretty much like Chicago did, except that it had mountains. And when I got there, I also realized that I was really alone. And I think I realized that I was more alone than ever because my house was not a place where you felt that there was a lot of friends. That was usually the enemy camp there. And so I was real dependent on my friends. And here I was in a place where I didn't know anybody. So I got off to school. And the first day I got to school, not only was I feeling really lonely there and, you know, didn't know anybody and was really missing my friends and understanding for the first time, you know, that I was not going to get to graduate with the people that I had come with and everything, but I looked different. And I was raised in the Chicago atmosphere, and we were real attached to American Bandstand. And every night we'd get off the school bus, run home, turn on American Bandstand, and make sure we were dressed like them and see who was dancing with who and what was going on and everything else. And I knew really into American Bandstand. I am here to tell you that the girls in Utah did not only dress like them, they didn't even pay attention to that important stuff. So here I had, you know, my felt skirt and my saddle shoes and my big socks and my sweater-on backwards and my little collar and all my stuff, and I got there, and the little girls from Utah were wearing matched skirts and sweaters, and their little tiny thin socks were rolled down like little donuts around their ankles, and they wore these funny shoes that weren't out saddle shoes or penny loafers, and I'm standing there, and I am feeling really alone. The people that looked like me were down in the corner at the Spread Nut Donut Shop, and they were on Harley David chopped hog motorcycles, and their boyfriends had leather jackets and chains. So I didn't belong down there. You know, I didn't belong there. I didn't belong inside the school, and I didn't belong at home. My mom and dad, through this course of this year, went through the worst part of their marriage. They had some things happen to them personally and amongst themselves. That made life at home more difficult than it had ever been before. My mom left home a couple of times that year, and they fought constantly, and there was a lot of stuff. And here I am, you know, I'm a senior in high school, I haven't got any friends, and nobody's going to ask me to the prom, and it was a bad year. I mean, I should get you all just crying over that, but it's really bad. So anyhow, the way that I coped with that was I didn't go to school. I checked it out, and I had enough credits to graduate if I didn't set another foot into that school, and so consequently I would take get to school, get into the first class, they'd take the attendance, and I would walk downtown, and I would walk up and down the streets of downtown until it was time to go home, and somehow nobody even noticed that I wasn't there. I mean, not even the school didn't know I wasn't there, but finally one day they did notice that I wasn't there, and they called my mom and said she doesn't come to school, and, you know, it was no big deal. You know, she says, I think you need to go to school, and I says, I hate school, I don't have any friends, and so I got a little part-time job and put most of my efforts that year into working, and at the end of that year, I did graduate, and I don't remember that. My dad had our little 16-millimeter films put into a video a year ago, and there were some parts of it that had me graduating, you know, with the cap and gown, and I do not remember the event. When I saw that, you know, it was a realization. I knew I graduated. I mean, I knew I did, but I didn't really remember it. So I worked a lot that year, and at the end of the year I got on a train and I went back to Illinois to see my friends graduate, and I think that's where I learned one of my other lessons, is that once you're gone, you can never go back. You know, it's like putting your hand in a bucket of water, and when you take it out, you know, the place is gone, and that's kind of how that was. So I didn't have anything in Utah, now I don't have anything in Illinois, and I was really feeling bad. So my dad got me a job where he worked, and I don't know how long I worked there, when all of a sudden a man came to fix our calculator in our department, and I had met him one other time, and he asked me if I would like to go out, and it was the first social event that I had in a year and a half, and I was extremely grateful for the invitation. And so I took him home to meet my mom and that, and make sure, because he was a much older man, and I said to her, could I go out with him, and they both agreed, and so anyhow we went out on a date. And I should have known on our first date that I was in for a long haul, because, I mean, he had clear signs of alcoholism on our first date. But a year and a week later, I married him. But during that year that we dated, he lost his car, and I helped him find it. And he called me up, and I said, you know, we were supposed to go to the canyon for breakfast with my mom and dad this morning. Where are you? And he says, well, I'm still in bed. And he says, and I don't know where my car is. And I said, well, I'll come and help you find it. So I got in my little car, and I went over to his house, and we just drove all over Ogden looking for his car. And I mean, signs of insanity were really there. We never looked in the garage. I mean, there was a little scene, but it was in the garage. And there was another time where he kissed me goodnight and fell off the porch. There was there was numerous occasions when he would kiss me goodnight and ring the doorbell. And you know, I was trying not to let my mother know what time I was getting in, and he would ring the doorbell. And there were many times when we would set up a date, and this was 7 o'clock, and 7 o'clock would come, and 8 o'clock would come, and 9 o'clock, and somewhere around 9:30, he would call me and say that, you know, he'd been playing shuffleboard, and time just kind of got away from him, and that he'd make it up to me tomorrow, and he'd get there a little early, and we'd do something really nice together. And one of the things that I always felt about that is that if I was prettier, if I was more than what I was, shuffleboard wouldn't be so important. You know, I'd be more important than the boys down at the keg and the shuffleboard game. And so I knew that if I was more, I would be better and he would be on time. And I, you know, that went on for years. Because I can count on both hands the number of times that man came home for dinner in 25 years. You know, which isn't very many. And I knew that if the dinner was better, or if I just could keep my mouth shut and not yell at him that day, if I didn't have to call him at 5 o'clock and beg him to please come home, and not make such a pain of myself, that probably he would like me better. There were times when I thought perhaps the secretary was charming. You know, I put myself through a lot of agony through that kind of stuff. But I never felt like I was enough. You know, if I would have had any kind of education about what alcoholism was and that it was a disease and that he didn't have a choice about his life once he took a drink and it didn't have anything to do with me, you know, I could have saved myself 25 years, you know, but I didn't. I knew that I was not enough. And there were signs of alcoholism that I couldn't see because I brought him home, and what I brought home was a drinking partner for my dad. I mean, my dad just loved him. And it was love at first sight for those. Now, my mom didn't think that he was so hot because he had been married before, and of course she had higher standards for me, but my dad thought that I'd made a great choice. And when George drank like my dad, I knew I'd brought home the right boy, you know, the right guy. He had a job. He had worked for the company 7 years. He had a car. He was doing its service, so he wasn't going to go off to Guantanamo with all the rest of the guys who, you know, were my age. And I just thought that I was real lucky. I was real lucky to have him. So anyhow, we got married. Now, the other thing that should have given me some clue about alcoholism was we got married on Veterans Day. And in Utah, they have state liquor stores. And the most important part of this wedding was to make sure we had enough booze. The wedding was at my house, he and my father were consumed for weeks to make sure that they had enough. And on the last day, they decided that probably enough wasn't going to be enough, and they made another trip down there. They didn't care if I had a dress, you know, if we had tables, if we had a kitchen, just as long as there was enough liquor to get us through the wedding. So anyhow, that's how that went. We got married, and 9 months and 2 days later, I had a son, and I wasn't really prepared for that. I mean, I had a younger sister who was 6 years younger than me, and a brother that was 9 years younger than me, and I'd had all the kids I could stand. My mom always said, "Take the kids with you." You know, I felt like I was dragging these kids around with me, and I feel glad to get out of that house and get away from them. And here I turn up pregnant and have one of my own. And I really didn't know how I felt about that. But when he was born and I got to see those perfect little hands and the perfect little feet and everything, and I thought to myself, this is going to be okay once I learn how to take care of him. So my sister was always a person who babysat and did things for others, and so I recruited her for a while, and she taught me about diapers and everything that I needed to know. And I set about being a good mom. The other thing that I set about trying to do was to get my husband home. Alcoholism was not a problem for me until 2 years before we got into the program. My obsession for all those other years was the fact that he wouldn't come home. He just wouldn't come home. And I would call the office every day at 5 o'clock and say, "Are you going to come home? You know, I'll be there in 10 minutes." And I'd call back in 10 minutes and say, "When are you going to come home?" And he'd say, "I'll be there by 6. And I'd say, "When are you going to come home?" And he'd say, "God, don't call me anymore, you know? And it'd be 9, 10 o'clock. I mean, it was always 9 or 10 o'clock when he would come home. So really, alcoholism was my main obsession. I didn't even notice how much he was drinking. You know, I didn't even, because I did, that was just not a thought to me, because he was drinking the same way everybody drank that I ever knew, but he worked different than other people I knew. And that was a real problem for me. So I spent the next, 21 years being obsessed with workaholism. One of the other obsessions that I had was the fact that I could never get him off the couch. When I would finally get him, when he would finally come home, he always had two beers on the way home. And I mean, every night he had two beers. They were large. But I knew that if I could keep him from having the third, I could feed him and he wouldn't go to sleep. I mean, if I could just feed him. So I would do everything that I could, and sometimes, you know, it was yelling, screaming, whatever it was, to get him to eat before he would go to sleep on the couch. And most of the time I succeeded in that, and it cost me plenty. Mostly my dignity. And he would fall asleep finally on the couch after he ate this perfectly kept dinner, because I decided that if he wasn't going to come home, I fed the kids at 5. They were hungry. They were boys, and they were active, and they were outside all the time, and I fed them at 5. And so I set about making sure that this dinner didn't crust up or dry out or, you know, look bad, and that the peas didn't deflate. And I mean, that takes a lot of work. A lot of work. And you get a lot of resentment. I was angry all the time, you know, and so the only two people in my life that got the brunt of that anger were the boys. You know, they were the ones who did not get any of my emotional support. And my anger didn't come out straight, it came out sideways, you know, and I was always yelling about unmade beds and garbage that wasn't out, and don't tell me what happened at school today until you go make the bed. How come the kitty litter's out? Who didn't put their jacket away? Why is this hat laying here? How come your homework's not done? Nag and nag. And they could never come to me and say, Mom, let me tell you what happened at school today. And I'm real sorry about that today, but I try to give anybody who wants to talk to me, I try and give them my undivided attention, because that's part of what I try to do in recovery today, and because it's so important. And I didn't learn it easily. It's been a lot of work for me to even today give Stephen my undivided attention, because in the back of my mind I'm thinking, God, I got this to do and that to do, but I really have to work at giving people my undivided attention today. So anyhow, that's kind of how it was. The other thing that I said I would never do, I did, and that was to scream. I thought it was a real character asset to be able to call your kids home from the beach in the summer from your back porch. I mean, I could really scream. And it didn't matter whether they were at the beach and I was on the back porch, or whether they were in the kitchen and they were in the kitchen. The level of that voice was always the same. I was a screamer. And, you know, I know today that I have a choice over that. And I heard myself scream shortly after we had gotten in the program, and they were having an argument. We were getting ready to go to an AA meeting. We were already spiritual. And we were getting ready to go to an AA meeting, and they had these concert t-shirts. And I mean, they were really important. And the law of the land is you do not touch somebody else's concert t-shirt. And Scott dared to invade Stephen's privacy and took his best t-shirt and was going to wear it to an AA meeting. And they were starting to fight down at the end of the hallway, and I still didn't know about let go and let God and mind your own business. I mean, I was hearing them, but I didn't know how to apply that. And I was in the kitchen, and they're down at the far end of the hall, and I'm starting to give them my opinion about why they shouldn't be yelling at each other about concert t-shirts, and God let me hear the sound of my voice. And I thought to myself, my God, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. And most of the time now I am fairly quiet. There are times, and you know, none of our character defects are ever removed from us permanently. That, you know, it's contingent on spiritual maintenance, and on days when I feel extremely frustrated, I have a tendency to raise my voice. The problem is that it doesn't work as well as it used to anymore, and I only do myself a lot of damage if I do that, and I think to myself, and the other thing it costs me is my dignity, and I have given the disease of alcoholism all of the dignity I care to give it, and today my main goal is to be a lady, and ladies don't scream. And somehow that was the end of that deal, or at least a major awareness about screaming. So it was real difficult for the kids not only to get my attention but also to bring kids home, because they never knew, as I never knew, what was going to set me off. And I embarrassed them. You know, they'd bring kids home to play in the driveway with the skateboard, and if they hadn't taken out the trash, it was not unlike me to yell out the window and use a few cuss words and say, you know, about the garbage. And so it got to a place where they found it to be more comfortable to be at other people's houses, just as it was for me when I was growing up. It was easier to go somewhere else where it was quiet and you could play the piano and sing and be kids, and that's what they chose to do. I always thought that I provided them with a good home, and I did. You know, it was clean. It was real clean. You know about perfectionism. You know, it was another case of defect, and the house was clean, and I did six meals, and they did go to school clean, and that was the best I could do. You know, and I thought that I was being a great mom, and I really was. I have to give myself credit for that today, because I was, you know, I was being a good mom in that area, you know, and I had areas that I wasn't so hot, but I was in that way. So anyhow, that's kind of the way it was. By the time it was 2 years before we came into the program, I began to notice that things were going, I mean, I really could see that things were not going well at the house. I started to notice that we had a pickup truck by then. Stephen was 16 years old and got a pickup. And I noticed that the back of the pickup always had a lot of empty beer cans. But I justified that by saying, you know, he's 16 years old, he lives in Texas, he's got a pickup, he's trying to be a cowboy or jocker, I don't know who he was. But I thought, you know, I guess 16-year-olds just drink. You know, I would say just run around. Maybe he didn't think to do it. Maybe he just went along the side of the road and picked up cans and put him in the scrubs and see it cool. Surely that was what was going on. Then a little more time progressed, I noticed we were losing things out of the house. And I would say, like, where did that go? And they'd say, I don't know. Scott, did you ever see that before? No, I never saw that. Steve, did you ever see that? Mm-hmm. And I think, well, we used to have one. I know we used to have one. Well, maybe we didn't have one. Probably not. I probably am wrong. Then I began with a series of events to them stealing things out of my home to wonder if I was the one who was sane. And I would find things in pockets and in closets that were strange. Visine, little pills, little bags, little silver things, lots of little gadgets, and I'd say, what do y'all do with these? Well, they had a wonderful explanation for everything. The visine was because when they ran, Stephen was involved in a lot of sports. He was a cross-country runner, a swimmer, worked a full-time job, got A's in high school, and who would have ever thought that he was having the trouble with drugs and alcohol? I mean, he was a star. And I would suggest to him, why was the Visine in your pocket? This is like the fifth bottle of Visine in 2 weeks. And he'd say, well, when I run and we get in the grass, my eyes burn, and I use that in my contact lenses. Well, that sounded okay to me. And it wasn't until after I got here, you know, that they said when they're smoking pot, their pupils get huge, and they use the Visine to dilate, to get that all back into. And the other thing that I found out here is we were getting less and less eye contact. They'd walk in at night, and I would say, just come and tell me where you've been. And they'd say, I've got to go to the bathroom. And they'd run around the back part of the house and into the bedroom, and I wouldn't see them. And I have a lot of tricks that they use when they're involved, you know, in the disease, that they have ways of covering it up. And so it wasn't until February of 1981 that I realized that not one of my sons, but both of my sons, were full-blown alcoholics, and they were 17 and 15 years old. By the time February 9th came along of 1981, Scott, the day before, had stolen the last of what we had in the way of jewelry that was of any value. And we didn't have much, you know, but mostly the thing that got me was he had taken all of George's award pins from his company, and they were all 14 karat gold, and each year that he was, every 5-year increment that he was with the company, they would put a semi-precious stone in there. And they were just little pins, but he had them. He was with the company 33 years, so he had accumulated a lot of them. And the last thing that that boy walked out of was George's award pins. And I confronted him about that, and he said, yeah, he had taken them, but that there was not any way that we could get them back, that they had taken them to one of those gold and silver places. And, you know, my first thought was if those kinds of places weren't available for kids, they wouldn't steal, you know. They always want to, I don't know, I'm not different. You know, they always want to blame this stuff on somebody else. I knew that if Scott didn't run around with this one particular guy, that he was going to be okay. The fact is today that this young man has 5 years of sobriety, and Scott hasn't been able to gather up any sobriety at all. And so I know that it wasn't because of him. It's not because of anything. It's alcoholism, it's a disease, and it kills people. So anyhow, that day I had already heard from a friend of mine that about alcoholism, and so when we realized that there was something going on here, by this time too, I had helped to grow mystery seeds, and I always like to tell this story. They came home from high school one day with a little bag of seeds, and they said that it was a science project, and that they needed some flower pots for their science project, and that they didn't know what their seeds were. And we were to take notes and grow the seeds, and everybody was to go back to school X number of weeks later and report what they had grown, whether it was beans or, you know, whatever. So I got 10 yellow 10-inch flower pots, filled them with the best dirt money could buy, and I stuck them in solar exposure in my bedroom, and we planted our mystery seeds. And, they came up. They were great. And it wasn't too long until I knew they were marigolds. And every day, I would come home from work, and I would turn on marigolds and water them. And at night, all of the little boys from the neighborhood would walk past our mystery seeds, and everybody was so proud of our science project. And this went on for several weeks, and our mystery seeds are now up about this high, and they are real healthy. And they're real green, and they're real pretty, and I'm real proud. I mean, you know, I've taken a big part of this, and I wanted to be a part of their lives, and I was helping out with the science project, and I was feeling good about myself. I was giving it my undivided attention for once. You know, I was really into something. And I came home from work one Friday night about 6:15, and I walked into the bedroom, and the pots were there, and the plants were gone. And I was devastated. I thought, my God, what is the science teacher going to think? It's Friday night. I can't call until Monday. It's too late to start the project over. The kids are going to fail. I mean, I had all of these feelings inside of me about what was I going to do when the kids find out that the seeds are gone. I figured the cats got in there, and, you know, but I couldn't see any evidence, you know, of the plants being there. And I was really upset. I thought, how are you going to explain this to the teacher? So I thought, okay, get your mind off of this and go about your business. So I went to put some laundry away, and when I went into Scott's closet, the mystery seeds were drying against the wall, and I realized somehow, somewhere inside of me that they were not marigolds, that I had helped them grow marijuana. And that was really a funny story, except inside of me, I can still feel the feeling that I felt. I felt violated. I felt abused. I felt ridiculous. I thought, how could they have pulled this over on me and I not know about it? I should tell you all the ways I feel. I was embarrassed for myself, for taking part of that, for not being able to recognize what was going on. And I think from what I've heard, the other explanation for that is that it would be a lot like rape or having your house robbed, that feeling of just you know. And that's how I felt. And we went out and checked the yard and found out we had mystery seeds growing everywhere. It's everywhere. So anyhow, on February 9th, I approached Scott about bringing back this stuff, and he said that there was no way, and I said it better be back here by 4 o'clock when I get home from work or there's going to be trouble. And I was so upset, I called in sick at work and stayed home. I mean, I couldn't even think straight. And about a half hour later, he called me from school and said to me, if you'll take me up to that place in Denton, he says, I'll see if I can't get better from what I do. And he says, and if not, I'm going to commit suicide. And a lot of us take and put our kids into treatment thinking that in 28 days they are going to be cured of the disease, and that is the saddest deception we can do to ourselves. Because I really put that boy into treatment thinking in 28 days he was not going to steal. He was never going to call me a bitch again. He was never going to be late for school. He was going to go back in school and do his work. And I really believed that they were going to fix him in 28 days. I did, however, attend Al-Anon during that time, and I'll tell you how I went. It was not willingly. But when people tell me about putting their kids into treatment and have that little smirk, I think to myself, oh, God. It's a quick fix. And it was for me. My second son got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous on March 30th of 1981, and because of a sponsor and a big book and a lot of meetings, he is sober continuously for 8.5 years, and he is really doing well. And so I think that y'all have it over a treatment center in your day. That's my opinion. I think that some people get a lot of help from them, but it didn't work for me, and I got to see, you know, that Alcoholics Anonymous and the love and the fellowship here heals people and makes them well, and if they want it. You know, it's all about if we want it. You know, we all get the same taste of it when we get here, and it's if we want it. You know, we get to stay, and if we don't, you know, like we say in Aaron, I come to 6 meetings, so we'll refund your misery, and we all have a choice about how miserable we want to stay. So they told me to go to Al-Anon, and I explained to them that I was much too busy to go to Al-Anon. Don't you know I work? George doesn't come home from work. I have lots of pets. They all need food. I have to iron and vacuum and do all this stuff, and I can't then have time to go to Al-Anon. By the time March rolled around, I no longer had a social life of my own, and we no longer had guests come to the house, because the first thing we would say, George would say, was, what would you like to drink? And they'd still have their coats on. We never said, can I take your coat? It's what you wanted to drink. So that was quite entertaining. And if I would leave the house, there was always a fight or a battle that went on. When I come home, and I was either mopping up salad dressing or broken dishes, and it just got to a point where I stayed home. It was just easier to stay home. So I was a prisoner by the time I got here. So they said, go to Al-Anon, and I'm trying to explain to them about my busy life. And when she finds out how busy your life is, she says, this kid is getting some recovery here, and he can't come home to an old idea. And you need to go to Al-Anon, and he can't visit. And I said, but he's only 15 and a half years old, and he needs his mother. And I was willing to give him away a few days prior to that, but they told me I couldn't visit, and all of a sudden I got very motherly and said, I have to be there. And she says, you can't come if you don't go. They have my number. So I thought to myself, I didn't like the number of hours that they were giving me to visit at the treatment center, so I thought, okay. I figured out the schedule, so they took them to open AA meetings from the treatment center, and I decided I would go to those meetings and get there a half hour early and stay a half hour later. And the 2 meetings that I went to, which was the treatment center desk, I got an extra 2 hours of visiting, and they wouldn't have to know about that. And also, I could go there on Wednesday, and so I'd been to 2 meetings that week. And so that's how I got into Al-Anon. Now, I wanted to sit on the couch at the front door. I did not want to go into the Al-Anon meeting, because I figured, you know, that was for them, and I'm too busy, and I could be doing something else instead. But the first time that I tried that, I thought, well, somebody's probably going to come outside and say, you really need to be in a room. So I thought, well, I can tolerate, and it's like the little thing says, you can tolerate anything for 12 hours if you knew you didn't have to do it for the rest of your life. So I thought I could sit in that Al-Anon meeting for 1 hour, you know, twice a week, and get them off my back. And somehow or other, in those hours that I sat there without wanting what you had, it started to penetrate and filter in, and I started to feel the magic of Al-Anon before I had any idea what was going on. And I am here to tell you that up until this year, I went to at least 5 or 6 Al-Anon meetings a week, religiously, along with open AA meetings. I mean, I was out there any time a door was open, I was in a meeting. And my father came to live with me last August, and he is a cancer patient, and I was still trying to do radiation and chemotherapy and 5 meetings a week and go with George and everything else, and I thought, my God, there's a lady down in Brownwood that says sometimes we go to so many meetings we haven't got time to work the program. And I thought to myself, I think this is a time where I can maybe go to 2 Al-Anon meetings a week and try and work some of the program at the house, because I was going to a lot of meetings, but then there was so much going on at the house that I was feeling real unbalanced. And so for 1 year I have had to go to 2 Al-Anon meetings a week, and that might seem like that's not so bad, but that has been a real hardship on me. And I've talked that over with a couple of people that I really admire, and they say it's really okay, you know, because along with that, I am with the fellowship in what we do, and I'm around people, and I sponsor people, and we have people from the fellowship at the house all the time. And so there is no part of our life where there's anything but Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous going on. But for me, for right now, I feel like I am being deprived. So anyhow, that's how it started for me, and all of a sudden I realized, you know, that we did have an alcoholic son. And on the 23rd day of February, my husband said perhaps he had read something in the big book about, and was at the treatment center, and it was about the guy who jumps in front of the streetcar and breaks his leg and then goes back out and does it again. And he says, you know, that's me. He said, I keep going out there and getting my leg broken and thinking it's going to be okay and tomorrow I'm not going to drink. And he said, as we were driving home that day, he says, tomorrow night when we'll see at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, he says, I'm going to get a desireship because he says, I know I'm an alcoholic. And I said, you've got to be kidding. I mean, I am already knocking bottles. I mean, I am as crazy as they come. There's a line in our opening that says, alcoholism is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted. And I thought, yeah, that's right. And then it goes on to say, by trying to force solutions, and we become restless and irritable without knowing it. And I've been trying to force solutions, and I was about as restless and irritable as anybody there ever was. And I'm doing all those crazy things, and he says he's alcoholic, and he's going to get a trip tomorrow. And I say, you've got to be kidding. You know? So, I mean, that's how far and how deep-seated my denial was. I know the day that my denial saved my life for as long as it was a tool. Because if I could not have denied the alcoholism, if I would have known a day sooner that my boys were alcoholic and so was my husband, I could not have lived with that information until I came to you. And after I got into the AA meetings, and now Scott's got a desire chip in his pocket, and Georgia's got a desire chip in his pocket, and I'm going to the AA meetings, I'm starting to feel real guilty. And I'm thinking, I failed. If I would have done it just a little bit better, which is my feeling from being a little kid, you know, if I'd have done it just a little bit better, if I could have been a better mom, if I wouldn't have yelled so much, if I would have cooked macaroni instead of rice, I wouldn't have been alcoholic. And I have that sign up there on the podium, and it says, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it, and it took the pack off my back. I wasn't exactly sure right from the beginning what all that meant, but they kept telling me I did the best I could with what I had. And I didn't understand that either, but for some reason or other, it made me feel a little bit better. And today I know that I did the best I could with what I had. And that there was nothing that I could have done any different because they were alcoholics. I mean, they were alcoholics and they were going to be alcoholics no matter if I baked chocolate chip cookies or not. And I know that today, but the feelings that I had at first were really, I felt really guilty. The other thing is that y'all made us feel precious, just like you guys have made me feel precious here today. They made me feel precious at my first AA meetings because here we were coming with the kid and my husband and I were all new and we were getting excited about it and we'd walk in and sound so precious. And they're here and he's got huge to sobriety and she's going to AA and isn't it wonderful? And oh God, I just felt, you know, it just was a cinch. And then on March 30th, Steve came in. We had a little interesting thing happened with him and we were given enough information that we didn't have to put up with unacceptable behavior, even if it was from our children, and that as long as we had three people in recovery, that I had a choice as to whether or not the fifth one could live there actively drinking and using. And so armed with a little information, and I had began to understand that what you shared here with me was your experience, strength, and hope, and I began to believe you. I knew from what you were telling me that it was true stories, that they weren't made up, and you had promised me that you could only share your experience, strength, and hope here, and that we weren't allowed to share what we think. You know, people had been telling me what they think they would do if they were me out of my life, but here you came and said, I lived through that. I know how you feel, and this is what we did. It's not what the neighbor did or what they suggested, the school suggested. This is what we did. We asked our child to leave. Oh. And I didn't want to do that. But I also knew that we had recovery going on at the house and Steve could not stay there if he was drinking. So he came home from work that day and he was drunk and I saw it for the first time. Scott said, my God, man, he's always been worse than me, of course. And so on Monday, March 30th, we took Steve into his first AA meeting. We asked him to leave or go to a meeting. And he decided to go to a meeting and make a choice. And so we drove into the first meeting, and there was a lot of alcoholism in the car that night. Steve wore a coarse hat, a tequila t-shirt, kitty shoes, no knees in his jeans, his hair down to here. And when George Kopp started out in the rearview mirror of the car, he said, you can't take him to AA looking like that. And thank God Scott had just a little bit of sobriety, and he said, Dad, it doesn't matter what you rate Alcoholics Anonymous, just as long as you come. Well, George says he wasn't going in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous with a kid that looked like that when he got out of the car in the middle of the highway. Now, here's where my belief kicked in. I knew that it was necessary to get the boys to AA, so I jumped out of the passenger side around to the driver's side, and I drove the boys to AA. And Stephen walked in the door, and a lady named Millie was there that night, and she's an AA lady, and she said, "My God, Beverly, that boy is half dead." And I didn't see that. I could not see the disease of alcoholism in my children or in my family. And she asked a guy named Bob P. to talk to Stephen, and he says, "I've had all of these kids I can stand. I'm not talking to any more kids. They don't stay sober. They waste your time." And I just really had a little bit of sobriety over Bob, or a little authority over Bob. And when I got out of my own, I'm meeting Bobby Head, Stephen in the back room, and he was talking to him. And to Bobby, I got to see the miracle of recovery, because that man, Stephen, got groceries at a supermarket in the middle of the night, and that man set his alarm clock, and he would go down to the grocery store at 1 o'clock in the morning and sit with Stephen, and they'd read the book. And he got Stephen to sell a concert ticket that he had waited in line for 2 weeks. And he told us about being responsible and making beds, and that I was supposed to let them learn how to cook. And I thought that was my responsibility to take care of them. And now my friend of mine says, "If you died tomorrow, would they know where the eggs were?" You know, and I had done such a good job of loving them, I almost loved them to death. And I did not want to share my washing machine with a irresponsible 18-year-old, but Bobby said I had to. And finally, time went on, and I was really getting involved, and Bobby's trying to get Stephen recovered from alcoholism, and we're going to meetings, and people are calling us precious, and I was really trying to help Bob with Stephen. Finally, one day, he stuck his finger in my nose and said, "Get a sponsor. If you knew anything about alcoholism, we wouldn't have this mess today. Leave me alone with Steve and get a sponsor." And he gave me a lady's name, and I called her. And for the first year or two that she was my sponsor, she was kept telling me it's going to be okay. You know, it's going to be okay. That's all she told me. It's going to be okay. She knew I was going to a lot of meetings, so she didn't have to tell me to read the book and go to meetings. So it's just going to be okay. And I really love her for that today, because that's all I really needed assurance from. My attitude was real cocky in the beginning, because we've got all of us are in recovery. And I could not see that alcoholism was a disease. I just knew if you got a desire, she can come to me. She stays sober, and you go to Al-Anon, and you get invited for ice cream, and everything you live happily ever after. And some woman would come into the Al-Anon meeting and say, "Harry's been sober 5 years, and he drank this weekend." And it was sort of awful. And I'd think, I don't know how to do it, you know. And I just have this arrogant attitude about alcoholism. And I wasn't too much younger when I got a lesson in that, because Scott stayed sober about 3 months and left. And I said, "Now what do I do?" And they said, "Get out the big book and start reading." You know, and I had to read. I was sentenced to read the first 33 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on a very regular basis until I understood that alcoholism was a disease. And so by the time he was 16 years old, we put him out of the house for the first time. Then he was 16 and a half years old, we admitted him to a second treatment facility, because he said if he could just be with kids his own age who understood about pot and beer, that he'd be better. And so we sent him off to a place in Minnesota, and he stayed gone for about 45 days. He went with a broken leg because he had gone out the window one night and came back injured. And I heard him come home. I thought he was sober, and I heard him come home that night with that leg. And we sent him off after we put a cast on him. We sent him off, and he came home the second time and stayed sober 6 weeks maybe, and he went back out again. And on Valentine's Day, when he was 17 years old, I did not get up that day with the intention of putting that kid out, but he had given me the tools to know that I did not have to accept unacceptable behavior. And I really wanted to give him every effort for recovery and not have to make that kind of a choice. But that day he came in, and one more time he called me a bitch, and one more time he punched a hole through a wall, and I put down the paintbrush. I was redoing a door, and I put down the paintbrush, and I said, "That's it. You have to go. You can't live here anymore." And Scott's never good for our health students. But there's neighbors out there, you know, and it wasn't too long until some little sweet girl picked him up and took care of him. And a long couple of years ago, he married one of his neighbors, and a year and a half ago, they had a little baby. And Sarah is about 15, 16 months old now, and they live in Florida. And Scott is still not in any kind of recovery, and the disease of alcoholism has taken a major toll on his life. And I went down when the baby was born and stayed with my daughter-in-law because she had a sister in, and I could see that they were now living in very active, very progressive alcoholism. And after I was there for 7 days, I had to leave, and I looked down at that little baby in the crib. And, you know, the only thing that I knew to do, because she taught me, was to know that she was in God's hands, and that God didn't have any grandchildren, and that she was not the first child that was going to be raised in very active, very progressive alcoholism, and that we are survivors, you know, and we make it. And there are some real tragic things going on. Scott's health is critical, and they're doing the very best they can, and they, you know, every once in a while he gets sent to a couple of AA meetings from the county, and he'll go for a couple of times and not go, but the thing is that my daughter-in-law calls him, and she says, yeah, I can tell people about how Scott is, but she's just someone that understands and can give me some real insight about what it is. And she said, I can get off the phone after talking to you and know that he's just not a drip. You know, but you lived through what I lived through, and of course I have not ever come even close to living through what that young lady is living through. But at least she says that there's something that she, that I got something she likes, but you know, we need to go to an animal meeting. Stephen did not want to finish college. He had been accepted to Texas A&M University when he was still active in his alcoholism. And he came into the bank one day and gave me back the beautiful parchment letter that the college gives you when they've accepted you for college. And he knew that I wouldn't screw in the bank, and so he said to me, I'm not going to college. He says, I make real good money stocking groceries at the time frame, and he says, and I've got this pickup, and I'm happy, and that's all I really want in life. And so he went about his alcoholism for another year. And when he got sober and started working with Bobby, they talked about why he couldn't go to college and found out that he was afraid of freshman English. You know, they couldn't. He was afraid of failing. He'd been an A student, but for some reason or other, he was terrified of freshman English. So Bobby suggested that instead of going to a major university, that he take a little junior college where the classes are smaller and a little more intimate and give that freshman English a try. And Stephen not only passed freshman English, he was the first pupil she ever had that she gave an A-plus to. And it gave him whatever he needed within himself to go on with his education. And 2 years later, he graduated from Brookhaven, and he reapplied for Texas A&M, and he was accepted, and he spent 5 semesters down at A&M. And in 1985, he graduated from there, and he's got a wonderful job down in Houston, and this little kid that came into Alcoholics Anonymous on March of 1981 with tequila hat and cool t-shirt and kitty shoes and long hair, with a three-piece suit, carries a briefcase, and he was just an absolute delight. Just an absolute delight. I have watched God work in his life, and I've watched Alcoholics Anonymous work in his life, and the recovery that happens when we're willing to do what we need to do. And I look at myself today, and I know I am not who I was the day that I came in here. I know that I have a God of my understanding. It took me a little time to find him. It was a matter of me listening to you tell about the miracles, and I sat for a long time and said, yeah, he does that for you, but he ain't going to do it for me. And I just knew God didn't care enough about me to be a personal part of my life. And one day I was sitting in a meeting, and somebody talked about God the miracle one more time, and I remember how I felt, you know, so much compassion for the miracle. And all of a sudden one day I had a little miracle happen of my own. I lost a check, and the lady at my bank that filed checks for a living found my check in a Walmart store, and she called me and said, did I lose something? And I thought to myself, I think probably under the guidelines of Al-Anon, that's a miracle. And I felt a joy in my heart that I've never felt before. And I thought, God, that's God. He gave me a miracle. And this last year, on the day that we found out that my father's cancer came out of remission, it was the same day we also found out how serious Scott was. And my sponsor suggested to me that it would be a time where I become very close to God. And I keep a journal every day. I spend 1 hour every day in prayer and meditation before I ever put my feet on the ground. And it's critical for me. It's absolutely critical. And it doesn't matter if I'm in Arkansas or Colorado or Houston or Abilene or wherever I am. I'll set the clock for enough time to spend 1 hour of my day in prayer and meditation, because I know that my conscious contact with the God of my understanding today is extremely important. And my sponsor suggested a year ago that I write down a miracle every day. And I thought, what a murder, I can't go through with it. You know, God is not that generous. But I am here to tell you that it was a year in August, and I have had a miracle every day. Sometimes they are so tiny that I can't find them. You know, sometimes it's just a parking place. Sometimes it's a letter from a friend that I thought about 2 days earlier. So I think, oh, I haven't heard from her for a long time, and there'll be a letter from that person in the mailbox. The other day, I have known for 5 years that we have two conferences that are back-to-back in August, and one of them is in Bryan, and then we drive all the way from Bryan up to Crested Butte, Colorado, and we get up there tired, and everybody's already had 3 days of sun, and I feel deprived easily. I have not given that one up. It just feels good. I've just been learning for 6 years about how deprived I am, because everybody gets to go to Crested Butte on Saturday, and I never get to go to Crested Butte on Saturday. And so this year, we got a phone call from one of the Trinity people last week, and she said to my husband, she says, I have really bad news for you. She says, we can't have that hotel on our regular weekend. She says, we can have it on August 22nd. And she says, that can be a problem for you and Barb. And he says, I don't think so. I got home from Atlanta, and then on that Thursday afternoon, and George says, Brian's been moved over to August 22nd. He says, they wanted to know if that was going to be a problem for you. And so I said, God, no, I'm going to Crested Butte on Saturday. And I'm so excited, though. I also sent my Crested Butte pictures out, and in a month I have not come back, because I'm out to one of my other places. So in my journal that day, I said, dear God, if you can fix conferences, you can shoot my pictures. And I'm here to tell you that afternoon those pictures were in the mailbox. Now, he doesn't do that good for me all the time, because sometimes his answer is yes, no, and wait a while. But there is, I guarantee you, a miracle in your life every day if you're willing to look for it. And when I know that God's walking that close to me on the days when I get some bad news or things don't go well with my dad, and then I've got poem about the footsteps, and I look behind me and I can't see but one set of footprints, so I know that the God of my understanding today has carried me that day. And I'm real grateful to know that. I'm going to tell you one last story and quit. I have had my very best friend in all my life was a 15-year-old German dog. And I've known for the last couple of years that she was, you know, we were coming to the end of the friendship. And on June 15th, she got to a point, she had arthritis in her back, and it progressed, and they told me one day she'd go down and she couldn't come up. And she had gone down and couldn't get up, but we were carrying her. You know, I thought, God, maybe if I just give her a couple of days, she'll get better. And you know, really in my mind, I knew that wasn't going to happen. And so on June 15th, we carried her off to the vet, and he told us about what a gift we'd given that dog, because he says, under normal circumstances, dogs, German Shepherds, don't live to be 15 and a half years old. And he said, you must have loved her a lot. And so, you know, we made the decision to put her to sleep. And I really need to tell you this because it was a gift for me. I was able to follow through completely on that friendship, and I held her head while we put her to sleep. And I knew that if it wasn't for me and the gift she'd given me, I would have handed her over and say, I can't do this. And so that's just the fact that she had given me, I stayed with her till the end. And I'm real grateful for what you gave me to give me to give that back to her. And there's been a lot of gifts. My husband is sober today, and our relationship is good. We have things in Dallas called family afterward meetings, which we attend regularly. And it helps us as a couple to rebuild, and we can hear that other couples are not doing too much better than we are most of the time. And sometimes we get ideas from them, and we've been able to put those ideas to work in our marriage. And on November 11th of this year, we'll be married 28 years, and I think that's a real miracle, because I think we were at the end of that by the time we got here. And so we have recovery in our home today, and I am most grateful for that. We have a son that likes to come home. He's 27 years old, and he likes to come home. I just want to see you, Dad. He calls me 3 times a week from his job, and just to say, you know, I was thinking about you today, Mom, and so I just wanted to let you know I love you. One of the things that we had to do in recovery was touch our kids and say, has anybody told you we love you today? And that was carried on through 8.5 years of the program, and we tell each other on a regular basis how much we care about each other, because during the years of active alcoholism, I think we forget to touch each other and to tell each other how much we care. And not only do we do that here in the meeting, but here we learn how, I don't know how many of you got here and when somebody touched you went like this, you know. But today some people say, you're the best hugger, and you taught me to be a good hugger. You know, because I know today that that's real important for us, because sometimes some of us aren't getting that kind of love and attention at home, and we do come to the meetings for nurturing. And I'm really grateful to be here today and be able to share with you some of my recovery. I know you saved my life. Perhaps not my physical life, but my spiritual life, because I know that I was so dead when I got here. And you've brought me back to life. And I am extremely grateful to each and every one of you for that. And thank you for having me.